This is a PlanetPhilip.com podcast.
Hello and welcome to another Planet Philip Tree podcast. This podcast is to talk about Half-Life 2 Episode 2. And joining me as always is Don, aka Unk. Good morning, Don.
Hi, Philip. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine, thanks. So here we are. We're at the end, essentially, and we've taken quite a long time to get here. I've taken approximately 37 hours just before the start of episode 2. I'm not sure how long you've taken, but so far you've taken 31 hours, but that includes nearly 3 hours of episode 2 that I've got. So far you're 28 hours.
Oh yeah, I guess I'm not accumulated yet on the last few chapters. I think those were pretty long. I think I would probably add about at least 2 hours there for the last couple.
Yeah, could be. But I mean, my 37 is before the start of episode 2 and your 28 is before the start of episode 2.
Oh, I thought it just included everything that was listed.
No.
So, okay.
No, 37. So here we are, episode 2. The first question's got to be, how many times have you played it already?
This would be my third time through episode 2.
Single figures?
Yeah, I played it, of course, you know, right when it came out with the orange box. And one time after that, I guess, for the achievements. I mean, not that I went for all the achievements, but it seemed like a reasonable time to replay episode 2 since it's been... Gosh, it's been out, what, 6 years now, right?
Yeah.
Close to it, yeah. So, I mean, it must have been three years ago, maybe, I replayed it. So, and then this time would have been the third. So, I'm not as familiar with episode 2 as I am with all the other games we've talked about.
So, why was there such a long break between the first playthrough and then the 3 years?
That's a good question, and it could not have been because of the quality or you know, my enjoyment of the game, because I think this is one of the best, you know, games in the Half-Life world. If anything, I would probably say because it would make me want Episode 3 or Half-Life 3 that much more.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, as I said, going on 6 years now, it's, you know, Valve is certainly not on an episodic release schedule. I started listening to the developer's commentary on episode 2 just last night. And the very first comment, you know, Gabe Newell comes on and says, this is the second in our trilogy of episodes, you know. So I don't know. Yeah. I doubt they're still on that path. Obviously, it's certainly, like I said, not an episodic release schedule. But here's hoping that we get something to wrap up the Half-Life saga.
That's true. It's a good point. I suppose many of us were hoping that, you know, once episode 2 had come out, we'd be thinking, okay, it wouldn't be that long until we get episode 3, maybe a couple of years. I mean, the difference between the date releases of episode 1 and episode 2 was about 18 months, something like that.
Yeah, it may not have even been that long. I think it was a little less.
It might have been a year even.
Yeah, which... You know, playing into when they decided to go episodic, I mean, it actually has a lot of merit to it. You know, you can release smaller, enjoyable episodes, update them as needed through Steam, change them as needed, and, you know, kind of get a smaller product out, maybe in the $15 to $20 range, something like that, more frequently. And that way you kind of keep the community alive, you keep new content coming, whereas now you look at the state of Half-Life 2 mods, and you know, we've gotten a big one about a year ago, Black Mesa finally released, and there's still a lot of work going on, but it's, I can't say it's become stale, but it's just become lethargic in the mod community now, and I think they could have sustained that a lot more, and thereby sustaining interest in the community around their games.
Yeah, I think... If I were Valve, or if I was sitting in on Gabe's exercise ball that he seems to have, I think I would go for a two-prong approach. I would go for a AAA game release every 5 or 6 years, but concurrently I'd run mini episodes. And when I say mini episodes, I mean like 3 hours thereabouts every couple of years. So I've got like a two or three episodes in between and then a main release. And those episodes would probably use most of the content from the main release. But, you know, they do such a good job with these things that they don't always have to have new content. They just have to make sure that we don't think it's like a AAA game. And that comes back to that idea of comparing episode one with Blue Shift, that when they were released as mods and the community didn't have as much an expectation as perhaps the community did for these episodes, which we saw them as full games. That makes sense?
Yeah, and I think, you know, building off that, I think episode two kind of took people by surprise. I mean, once it was in development, Valve had actually announced what they called the black box, which eventually got changed to the orange box, which, as we know, is a bundling of three top games. You know, you've got episode two in there, which we'll, you know, obviously talk about here. You have the excellent Team Fortress 2, which was not just a follow-on to Team Fortress Classic, but an incredible game in its own right. And yep. Still going strong, by the way.
Yes.
And we had Portal, the intro to Portal, which was based on some sort of a prototype game at was it DigiPen, the game design school, I think? Valve hires them directly, and it turned into a fairly short, maybe Portal's what? 3 hours long, 4 hours long, something like that. But a fantastic game and a great non-shooter, you know, FPS game, if you will. So it was sort of a puzzle first-person game.
And, FPP.
Right, FPP. So it was a really strong release. But back to my point of episode two, it went a lot further than episode one did in things like story development. And there weren't that many new weapons, per se. But you had a new adversary in the Hunter, and that, and I think the polish that they gave to episode two really made it feel like almost like a full AAA game release. It felt like it should have been Half-Life 3, perhaps maybe not quite that long. You know, not quite long enough, perhaps. But length doesn't always make quality in my mind. So I think it holds its own with Half-Life 2.
It does. There's no doubt about that. And the problem is, though, that I'm just using my times as an example. It took me just over 11 hours to finish Half-Life 1. It took me just over 12 hours to finish Half-Life 2. If we get Half-Life 3, I'm expecting the same kind of time. And I think many people will expect the same kind of time that it took them to play those respective games. So I do agree with you. You know, length of game doesn't make quality, but with Valve, if it's going to be less than 8 hours and it's a full game, I think people are going to be a little unhappy with that. But
I don't, maybe, but at the same time, you look at something like Portal and it's a short experience, but it felt complete and it didn't wrap up the story, but it was a pretty sufficient standalone episode. Of course, they built onto that with Portal 2, but I found Portal itself to be a very satisfying, self-contained experience, and I think maybe we can't look at Half-Life 3 the same way because it's not self-contained. But
and it's also part of the universe. We've become accustomed to longer games. I take your point, but because Portal was completely new for us, I don't think it stands that direct comparison. And I also think that the mechanics were much limited, and obviously visually it was much more limiting. That a 10-hour Portal game would have been, it would have been difficult to have, handled. I'm not sure I could have handled 10 hours of that.
Yeah, and although I think at the same time, the talk of, making Half-Life, we're maybe venturing too much into Half-Life 3 pondering here, but making it into some kind of open world or trying to compete or emulate some of the modern shooters out there is not Valve style and wouldn't fit the Half-Life universe, I think. So, to an extent, we'll just have to wait and see. And if if our listeners do play Episode 2 and it doesn't leave you wanting Episode 3, I wonder what's wrong with you. Half-Life 3 or Episode 3, I wonder what's wrong with you. But
anyway. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they did a fantastic job of, salivating us and thinking, wow, whatever's going to come next is going to be fantastic. And maybe they knew that there was going to be like a huge gap, and that's why they pulled out all the stops. to make episode two so good, so that when they knew the long wait was coming, we'd have something to tide us over.
It could be. And then, like I said, they've done a really good job of keeping Team Fortress 2 fresh. So it's in the same package as episode two. And I kind of wish they had paid, you know, spent a little bit of time making, you know, something like Lost Coast, you know, just a map or two here or there, add-ons to the Half-Life universe. Maybe not even starring Gordon per se, but
it
would have just injected a little bit of life and freshness into episode two, like they've done so well with most of their other games, honestly.
True. Okay, so this was my second playthrough, as was all of the Tree games. And I probably enjoyed it, how can I say this, almost as much as I did the first time, which, you know, for me, surprised me, because all of the other games I definitely didn't enjoy as much as the first time, except perhaps Opposing Force, because I really do love Opposing Force. So that was a nice surprise for me that, you know, I actually played through it and it was like, wow, yeah, this is really good. But also at the same time, it was countered by the idea of how much I did enjoy episode one as well. And in my mind, I'd always had this idea that when I first played episode one, I didn't quite enjoy it as much. And I don't know why I had that. So, you know, I was maybe making too much of a direct comparison with episode one and two. And I don't think that's a fair thing to do. I don't think we should directly compare these things to see which is better, because, you know, they're all part of a big story.
And like I was discussing, they do feel different, even though they're maybe titled similarly, you know, that episode one and episode two, but episode two feels bigger and more complete. And, you know, maybe that's for a few reasons, not just length per se, but there's a lot of time spent in, let's say, exposition, but, you know, story, advancing the story and certainly setting things up for whatever follows episode two.
It's actually only an hour longer for me than episode one was.
Well, yeah, I thought you might have shortchanged one of your times there on the chapter.
Really?
But yeah, maybe also, you know, the 33 minutes in Mutual Fiend beats even Kato Kid's speed run. So I thought maybe that was calculated wrong. But anyway, they're not too much different in length. Maybe an hour or two at the most, I would say.
Oh, okay. I'll double check on that, Mutual Fiend, and see what happens. So let's start with the chapters and work our way through. So the first chapter is To the White Forest, which is an interesting one because it starts with the train crash, which is nice because what we've got here is a direct continuation, more so than Half-Life 2 to Episode 1. I mean, I know that there's, you know, the Citadel explodes and you kind of, you know, you wake up at the bottom. But I don't know. Here it's like we're on the train. Or I wake up on the train. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. You know, although, you know, the one issue I have with, honestly, the one issue I have with episode two, but especially this chapter, is the sort of little recap sequence that they
do at the beginning.
At the very beginning. Yeah, it's a recap of, is it even Half-Life 2 included? I think it's really just episode one. And the events that directly led you to being on the train. I found that a little out of place, but I can't complain too much because even in the developer commentary, they mentioned that, you know, they had a decent amount of playtesters who had not played episode one, you know, playing episode two. So they had to not necessarily repeat or rehash some of the ideas from episode one, but they added a quick sequence here and there to kind of refresh your memory. Plus, if you hadn't played episode one, it introduced you to things like when Alex sniped for you in a later chapter. They found that if the playtesters hadn't played episode one, they thought that the laser sight was an enemy, so they avoided it at all costs.
Okay.
So they added a quick sequence of her shooting a zombie right in front of you that you can't miss while she's speaking. So it's a quick reminder that she's the one sniping for you. This is just like it was in episode one. And if you haven't played it, you know, don't worry, she'll cover you.
Yeah, they're going to definitely have to do that in episode three or you know, part three or episode two or Half-Life 3, whatever they call it, because with 6 years, there is a good chance that the players who play it won't have played episode two.
Yeah, that's true. That's a big gap.
it's a big gap. And I mean, they didn't do anything for Half-Life 2 from Half-Life 1 or from, I suppose, Opposing Force. But I think nowadays, because there's so much more story involved, and we must continue from where episode two finished, they're going to have to do something like that. So it'll be interesting to see whether they do the same thing, just a short, like, you know, trailer, as it were.
Yeah, it wasn't too long, and it was skippable. You know, if you hit escape, it just jumped you to loading the first map. So I can't complain too loud, but, you know, I'm nitpicking because I think this is one of the strongest Half-Life games. So got to give you some.
I mean, it actually happened to me. I was watching it the first time I played it, and then the phone rang or something, so I pressed escape thinking that would pause it, and it didn't. It just jumped to the menu, as you said. So I only watched it fully when I played it for the tree event. So there we go. So, I mean, this particular chapter is interesting because we get a couple of different environments. I mean, we obviously get the train, and then we get the train collapse from the bridge, which is pretty spectacular. And then we go work our way through some mines, and we get that great scene where we hear the hunter, and then we see it on the rooftop, and then it's gone.
Yep.
But it's not gone because it's in your mind, and you think, what the heck was that?
Right, and if you were sharp, you remember seeing it on the video in episode one. Do you remember that when? I think it was was it after the short video you see of Moss, Dr. Mossman.
When they go into the base.
Right, and then they have to leave quickly, and you see the camera knocked over. You see a quick shot of the hunter there. So it had obviously been in development before episode one came out, and set up here nicely in the opening chapter as something you really hate. I mean, it attacks Alex and takes her down, and so it's set up as a great adversary throughout the rest of the game here.
It's definitely my most hated enemy of the whole series.
It's interesting because it doesn't really have an analog in Half-Life 1 or Opposing Force. I can't think of any enemies that are so tough but aren't like boss, you know, battles, for example.
I don't know. They do remind me of the shock troopers.
Yeah, although the shock troopers are more... they're strong, but they're more on the level of like a human grunt, like a soldier, I think.
Sure.
And
just
hunters they're really tough. I played on hard this time, but they are really tough to take down. It's one AR-2 grenade that Combine Energy Ball does take them down even on hard. I was thankful for, but they are they're tough beasts to match up against.
They are. And then, as you mentioned, Alex gets taken away, so we have this kind of like twist, and we got like a side quest. We've got we're not sure whether we should look for her or what we should do. And then of course we wake up and we don't wake up. Once she's gone. Yeah, we do. We wake up and we have to follow the Vortigaunt, don't we?
Right. He takes her down to the mine shaft, and that leads into the next chapter where you have to basically go hunting in caves for the extract from the Antlion Guard. That's supposed to help.
This Vortal Coil.
Yeah.
Which is a great twist on the name, of course. I didn't like this chapter. I don't like being in those tunnels, and those ant workers are quite fun with a shotgun, but I'm not really a big fan of like sewers and tunnels and things. And
yeah, this would harken back, you know, I think in perspective when you look at the game, this was a great chapter in that it harkened back to the earlier days of you know, first person shooters and combing through the sewers of Black Mesa, let's say, or underground in Zen and things like that. But it provides a great contrast when you finally get out of the dark tunnels in the next chapter and it's bright and sunny, and the rest of the game, more or less, is kind of bright and sunny. I thought that was my point. It really provides a great contrast, and I'm glad they got this out of the way early. The crawling through the caves, and they provide a little different gameplay with the the Antlion Guard and not being, or what do they call it, the whatever that has the extract, the glowing Antlion Guard that you can't
kill. You can't kill. Right, that's a nice touch. Absolutely.
So an interesting bit of gameplay. Actually, some really interesting scenery. In a dark tunnel, yes, but it's still very interestingly done with the lighting and the glow effects and things like that.
But as I said,
I'm glad they got it out of the way early, and then the rest of the game looked different than anything we've seen, really, in the Half-Life world. Maybe akin to some of Half-Life 2, the outside sunny areas, but... it was an interesting chapter. Not my favorite, but I did like parts of it a lot, especially the turret defense, let's say.
Okay, you enjoyed that part, yeah? Where you had to...
I did, because it wasn't terribly challenging. It wasn't like the turret defenses in Half-Life 2, in Entanglement, I guess it was. I found the chaos interesting, and of course the comic relief in the two guys that you're working with.
The banter between those two is very...
It was just refreshing, and it kept things interesting. While you're doing that, you're not left alone with a couple of turrets. These guys are kind of helping you and guiding you here and there.
Yeah, absolutely. But this chapter is important, not necessarily for its design or for setting up the brightness, in the fact that at the end, when the Vortigaunts are bringing back Alex, not bringing her back, but re-energizing her or vitalizing her, we get the G-Man coming in, sticking his nose in, and clearly there's something going on here. He can suddenly just get into us and start talking to us, and he's paying a little bit of interest in Alex here, and what's going on here?
Right, it's a really memorable appearance by him. We haven't seen him at all since the very beginning of episode one, when the Vortigaunts kind of block him. And he kind of goes away. You don't see he doesn't make those little cameos here and there in the levels of episode one at all. So this is the first time we've seen him, and it's a good minute and a half, 2 minute soliloquy there that we get from him. And it has
We also get to see the rocket.
Right, exactly. It shows you, and the developer's commentary goes into this. It shows you it's kind of like a dreamlike sequence, and it shows you the past, the present with Alex, and the immediate future, where he actually shows you White Forest and tells you, make sure she's seen safely there. And then, so it really maybe doesn't advance the story so much, but it really builds a lot of intrigue, not just around him, but around what's going to happen when we reach White Forest.
Yeah, exactly. I quite like that part. That was, quite nice. And that takes us on to the next chapter, which is Freeman Pontifex. And as you say, we sort of come right out and we see that bridge. And that bridge, of course, is carrying all of the Combine and the advisors. And I suppose everybody used their Zoom to maximum effect to just maybe even watch it and then go back and replay that sequence and look in a different part. And
realistically it's not that far away. You'd think you might be spotted pretty easily by the guys on the bridge, but I realized why they didn't make it further away, because you wouldn't be able to see anything.
Did you shoot? I tried shooting at things.
I gave it a shot just to see what would happen, but it was interesting because they this is clearly a reward, from a game design perspective, this is a reward for getting out of the tunnels finally and safely. And just this, maybe 15, 20 second sequence. I mean, it does go on and on, but it's really only interesting as the advisor's passing and you get some dialogue with your, the Vortigaunt and Alex there. It's a brief sequence, but it's memorable. Plus Alex mentions that they're heading in the direction of White Forest. So already, not just from the G-Man speech, but already here, there's more tension being built around the finale of the game. What will happen when Alex and Gordon reach White Forest, and then what happens when the Combine reaches White Forest?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, and that leads on to like an open area where we got some of the thumpers, and we have to fight two antlions, which was quite nice. I hate antlions, not in the same sense that I hate hunters. I hate hunters because they're so difficult for me to fight against. But I hate antlion guards, because they're just horrible. but here I quite enjoyed it because there's so much open space.
Yeah, that plus they did give you some refuge in the little protected thumper in that one area. So it's not perfect, obviously. It's not a fortress you can just sit in, because there's not much ammo there, but it's a nice way to just kind of take a break for a second while after you run out of breath from sprinting.
Absolutely.
So I thought that was a well-designed area, and like we saw in episode one, it's simply a bit of a twist on a common enemy. Instead of one antlion guard and arena, we have a kind of a much larger arena with a couple of, or at least one sort of safe haven base in that protective thumper. And there's two guards that we have to fight against. And, of course, tons of explosive barrels, thankfully. So.
And antlions as well, are there?
Oh, yeah, there are antlions there. So if you wander out of your thumper area, those can be trouble, too.
Yeah, I think, for me, that's a real interesting lesson in design, because I've played, and I'm sure you have as well, played lots of mods where people have used two or three or even four antlions, and they put you in these situations and it's like a big open area and it's just boring. But Valve put so much more thought into this and so much more variety that it was quite fun to play, and I think that this is a good example of more is not necessarily better. Just because one might be fun doesn't mean three will be fantastic.
Right, they kind of upped the ante, as we say, but without going overboard and without frustrating the player.
I bet that took quite a lot of beta testing to get, how big should that area be to protect you? How many barrels? Those kind of things are all in the details.
Yeah, if there's one thing that Valve does well, it's playtesting and polishing and learning from watching their playtesters and learning from them.
Yeah.
And that allows them to release the games that are maybe not perfectly polished, but, are very friendly to new users and experienced users alike.
So. Exactly. And this leads us on to the huge puzzle. Which is the bridge puzzle.
Right, yeah, well, getting to the car, ultimately, but yeah.
Getting to the car, right.
I really liked this chapter, actually, after the antlion guards, which, I thought it was a good battle, but I'm not a big fan of antlion guards either. But when you take the elevator up and you kind of are allowed to look out over the whole industrial complex there, you could actually see the car in the distance on the bridge. And there's a camera shot showing a close-up of it. It's a great way to, as we mentioned before, kind of foreshadow or preview what you're going to be going through in the next half an hour or 20 minutes or something like that.
Definitely. And there's a cameo from G-Man on the bridge as well.
Right. I wasn't even quick enough to notice him until I played the developer commentary. So,
okay.
Yeah, it's actually one of relatively subtle appearance by him, because I tend to look down over the vista of the level in the industrial complex where he's kind of off to the left out of my main view. So
this particular section is similar to the ending section of episode one. In the sense that it's not a very big area, but it's very maze-like, but it's a linear maze.
Yeah.
And a lot of people talk about the negativity of linear. I mean, I don't have a problem with linear, because essentially most of the Half-Life games are very linear. Valve just does a great job of making it not feel that way. And this is, without doubt, my favorite section of the whole game. Just loved the three dimensions. I get to work in all different axes, but I never go back up, whereas sometimes you can go back up and start again and work your way down, but this one you can't. But I just loved it, all the nooks and crannies and looking for different ways to get over things. And of course you've got Alex with the sniper rifle, which you've already mentioned.
Right, that adds a nice, as you mentioned, sort of third dimension to it. Not only are you kind of constantly descending down to the sort of where the radioactive goop is outside, to go back up the hill to get to the bridge. But you're constantly covered from above by Alex, so that constantly reminds you that where you came from, basically, up above, I found was really interesting. I didn't find too much threatening here. I found this was more of a, not really a puzzle chapter, but it was a very interesting approach. Not really puzzle-based. There are small ones here and there. You, have an overall puzzle and a great one at the end with how do you get the car across the bridge. But in terms of making your way through the map, it's not really combat-heavy and it's not really puzzle-heavy. So I found it was interesting that it was so... It was still felt so interesting. You know, it felt good. It was a good map, I thought, good level. And I don't know. It's hard to describe, put my finger on exactly why we like... I think we both like this chapter so much.
I think the word you just used is the answer. It's intricate.
Yeah.
There is so many little nooks and crannies, and most of them don't lead anywhere, and you can only go one way, but there's a little variety. There's some small rooms, some big rooms, some rooms that are open, some rooms that Alex can shoot through. There's a few different enemies. It just contains all that sort of different areas up and down and across. And as you say, you get to the bottom and then you reach the goop, and you've got to sort of work your way across. And Alex is helping you there, but you can ignore her if you want to, because you can shoot the enemies directly, or you can let... you can lead them into Alex's view.
I thought the one great part of that was where you get to punt the tin roof tiles off of that one building and let Alex just clear all the zombies out, or not all of them, but a good number of them with the sniper rifle.
Or you didn't have to. You could just jump down and have the fun yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's the cool part.
I think one of the things that makes this chapter so strong, even though it's not heavy puzzle or heavy combat, is the little touches. For example, there's one scene you kind of come across right after you climb out of some of the radioactive waste pit there, where there were a bunch of zombies chasing you, and you find a little scene. It's just a folding chair, a couple of beer bottles, empty beer bottles, and a gun and some grenades. And that's the sort of like environmental storytelling that just sets a little scene of, okay, clearly one of the rebels sat here and drank beer and shot some zombies. Just little things like that. Another example was that I think when you're coming out of one of the first buildings, and off to your right there's a garbage bin, a big garbage bin, a dumpster, and there's some rustling around in there, and you see a cardboard box, come out of there, and it's clearly a zombie.
Yes, I remember that. That was so clever.
That's cool, but what they do is they give you grenades right there. So your first instinct is to maybe toss a grenade into that garbage bin. But if you tried that, what happens is the zombie tosses the grenade right back out at you. And from the developer commentary, that actually happened by mistake when they first had this, I forget what they called it, some physics entity that kind of rustled up props like boxes and things like that, and just kind of made it look like there was motion inside the garbage disposal. I don't think there was actually a zombie there until he tries to jump out. But they found playtesters would toss a grenade in, and just by happenstance, by random, the way this thing functioned, it happened to toss the grenade back up.
That's the grenade.
So they thought that was a great idea, and of course, then they forced it to happen. And they gave the player grenades right there, so it would be encouraged, the player to try it. So I thought it was a nice little touch to this level.
Absolutely. I forgot about that. That really was a fun touch. And then we get to the bridge, and we're on the bridge, and we see the car, and it's like, okay, shit, how are we going to get the car across? And it's probably the biggest puzzle in any of the games. I can't think that there's a puzzle bigger than this.
No, I thought, it's a great... almost hyperbolic example of a puzzle we've seen before in Half-Life 2 and Episode 1. It's the old seesaw puzzle, honestly. How many times have we done this, right? We've done it at least two or three times, mostly on a plank that we have to jump to a ramp. But
with a couple of bricks from Half-Life 2, Episode 2. It's one of the first puzzles we encounter, I think.
Yeah.
And you're right. It's just like a bit of wood, and you've got to put some bricks on so it doesn't fall down when you run up to the top. But of course, this is just, much smarter than that.
I can't wait for episode 3 where we have to do the same with like train cars or something like
that. Yeah, it could be. Could be.
I thought it was a great little puzzle, and it kind of brought a smile to your face once you realized what the solution was. Then that you probably recognized it from the previous games, you know. And then you finally get in the car, and it's like a souped up, muscle car. So.
Yeah, and then that finishes with us sort of driving over the bridge, getting to the area that's blocked off, and like a bit of humor from Alex, where she's like, "Oh my God, look at this thing, score!" expecting her to say, "Oh man, this is horrible."
What a hunk of junk, yeah.
Yeah, but no, she loves it, and she's shotgun, you know. Oh, I'm sorry, maybe the Vortigern wants to come along. So there's kind of like a bit of emotion that hadn't really felt that I got that from her before. So you know, that was kind of nice.
Yeah, they worked really hard, especially in this episode, to build Alex up as a companion, even though she fights with you less in this compared to episode 1, certainly, because she was kind of by your side almost the entire game in episode 1.
She was.
And as we mentioned, I think it got a little bit too much. You kind of want... Half-Life is a game where you mostly go it alone. You have some squad help in episode 2, in Half-Life 2. You have Alex's help a lot of episode 1, but it's really, at its heart, it's a single-player game. So...
It is.
I thought making her, adding a lot of charm to her, little funny moments like that, went a long way. Especially, they were especially careful to do that in the first chapter before she got injured, to make that make that have impact for you.
Make me want to save her. Make me want to. If okay, she's with me, then let's hope at least it's going to be funny or interesting.
Exactly. And now they're playing on with the sort of implied threat of the G-Man in the previous chapter, talking more or less directly to Alex. There's a little bit of maybe Black Cloud hanging over her, so you're not sure what's going to happen to her later in the game or in the next game. It just sort of ties you a little closer, together.
It does. Which leads on straight through that tunnel area to riding shotgun. Now, for maybe our non-native listeners, shotgun is the idea of being in the passenger seat. I don't know. Maybe is it because the police cars used to have a shotgun positioned in the passenger seat?
That's probably where it came from. I don't know for sure.
Yeah, no, I'm just guessing.
Yeah.
But so we get to do a little bit of driving here. And of course, it's quite fun to drive around in the jalopy, I think is the proper, the proper name for that. But I found the driving quite difficult. I don't know about you. I'm not a particularly good video game driver. Yeah, like everybody, I think I'm a great live driver.
This is a little different because it's, we're typically playing on a computer keyboard, which only has digital inputs for left and right versus, being able to turn the wheel just a little bit. So, yeah, it can be a little difficult. I thought this felt a little more out of control than the buggy in Half-Life 2, but I'm not sure that's the case. In other words, it was a little more difficult to go where you wanted it to go, but maybe they intentionally made it that way. So,
yeah. And am I right in thinking we actually get our first combat with hunters? I can't think.
Yeah, this is where you're ambushed with hunters, I believe.
Yeah, it was nicely done. They kind of get you in a, you go downstairs, check it out, I'll wait outside here kind of thing, and suddenly they're all on top of you, and there were like three or four as well. I think there were, or it seemed like it.
Yeah, no, there were, and it's often, it's maybe rare in Valve's case to do that, although they've, typically they'd set up a new enemy for you. They let you see it first, usually in a relatively safe location. Think of the shock trooper as a good example. You see one that kind of captures Barney or captures a scientist or something like that through the window.
It does.
And then later on you meet them, maybe one at first, and then you see them in squads. But here it's been hyped so long, you saw the hunter in episode 1 and then the big scene in the beginning of episode 2, that they make it a memorable ambush. And there are, four, I think, at least in that ambush.
But you've got the car. I remember killing at least one of them with the car.
Oh yeah, I didn't even get to the car before the next one came. There were a couple of waves, I guess, but
okay.
Yeah, this was a tough battle. I found especially on hard. It took me like at least 4 or 5 tries, I think, to get past these hunters and get back out to the. I guess you have to use the fix the radio first, use it, and then you can drive away. So
drive away, yeah, it's a tough one, but you get some great views. That I mean, there's like some really open views, which are kind of reminiscent of, as you say, from Half-Life 2. We had these coastal views. Well, clearly we're nowhere near the coast anymore, but what we do have is we have these mountain views and the pines, and I mean that's like the equivalent there. Those like the Photoshop. Not the Photoshop, but like the place where you take photos if you were on holiday.
Right, right. I know what you meant. Yeah, and then soon after that, we come to another memorable encounter with the advisor in the barn.
We do. Yeah.
Which I thought was well done. It wasn't, you know, it typically you might have difficulty as a designer dealing with a sequence like this because it's very non-interactive. You know, it's almost, you know, if Half-Life 2 and in episode 2 and episode 1 or would have cutscenes per se, this would be one of them.
Yeah.
So it does play out a little bit like a movie, but at least they don't take, you know, control from you or, you know, from your looking around away. But at the same time, it's a, there's not very much interaction here, but it serves its purpose in to set up the advisors as the real threat, at least as far as we know.
Yes. So far they're the most powerful.
And of course, and that'll pay dividends later in the game too.
Yes, and we can't effectively fight them. I mean, I've killed a couple in mods, but here we don't really get an opportunity to do anything.
Yeah,
do we?
Nothing we can do. I mean, I don't know if our weapons aren't taken from us, but we're immobilized more or less. And
yeah, we just can look around.
Yeah, but thankfully it's over pretty quickly. And we're back to driving. So I thought this, you know, overall, this chapter was a really interesting mix of things. It's not just a driving chapter, per se, like Highway 17 might be. Because it has these big sequences with the hunter ambush and the advisor. But then the second half, or maybe the last third or so, is all driving.
Yeah.
And it's great because it gets hectic there. Because you're starting to be chased by the chopper. And I thought it was a great... It's a great sequence, and I remember you worrying about how much you might have missed by just speeding things past, you know, past things as fast as you can go. But I don't. Maybe I should go back and check before I actually say this. But I don't think we missed that much because Valve knows you're going to be, you know, more
driving,
or less, driving chaotically through the railroad over the railroad tracks and between the cars and over zombies, which was great fun. You know,
I agree
also
with
meet
you.
Up with the hunter chopper at the end of the
end
of the map here. Yeah,
I agree with you, but I'd like to counter that by saying that Valve also wants people to replay things, and I think that there probably are things that I missed, but not important things.
Yeah.
Things that maybe are just like, for example, you mentioned the chair and the beer bottles, you know, and some dead zombies, little things like that that don't take away from the whole experience but could add to it if I replayed it.
Yeah.
And since this is effectively a replay, I felt that, oh man, maybe I should have gone a bit slower and stuff. And I don't know whether you can go slow. They do such a great job of almost kicking you up the bum every corner. Obviously that was what they wanted you to do.
Yeah, well, they chose a great enemy for this in the chopper in that you can always hear it. You know, you can always hear where it is, and it's usually always shooting you, even though it's not terribly accurate. I mean, it, you know, if you're standing still, it can get a good beat on you, but if you're moving, you know, you might get hit a little bit here and there, but it's not so threatening that, you know, you have to take immediate cover. So.
Yeah, no, it was a great end, and I actually had a lot of fun with this level at the end. Now, I'm the kind of beta tester who's always looking for ways to get out of the map. And in fact, Valve didn't do a great job of blocking this last area off. You know where you have to sort of walk under the trains and things?
Yeah, yeah.
And you have to leave the jalopy behind.
Right.
Well, once you're in there, there's a few places that you can get to where you can jump, not out of the map because they put invisible walls, but you can definitely see out of the map, which is highly unusual for Valve.
Yeah, well, it was common in Half-Life 1, you know, the Gold Source engine, let's say. But
okay.
Yeah, in the Source engine games, they've spent a lot of time to try to prevent that. So I'm a little surprised you can still do that. That's interesting.
Yeah, me too. But I went to extremes. I mean, I picked up all the boxes and things and put them in one corner, and you know, so that was quite interesting.
Yeah, I thought then, you know, to talk about this battle with the chopper at the end, I thought it was really well done because again, it's sort of an enemy we've seen before. You know, we've fought them usually with mounted guns or with the the gun that was on the dune buggy in Half-Life 2.
Yeah.
So it's a new way to fight a common enemy by throwing his own bombs back at him with the gravity gun. And of course, you know, from the perspective of the whole game, it's perfect practice for throwing the Magnuson device at a moving target, at the Strider. That you get here a couple chapters before you actually have to do that.
So. Yeah, that's a very interesting point. I hadn't considered that. And that the next one is called Under the Radar. And this is where now I remember. This is with the snipers, isn't it?
Yeah, this has, well, the mounted guns, yeah, they're kind of pinning you down.
Okay, yeah, the mounted guns.
So there's kind of two sections to this. First is while they're outfitting the jalopy with the radar to detect land of caches, you have to go deactivate these automatic guns. And I thought that was a great, again, overall, this chapter is a great mix of puzzle and combat later on. But this sort of approach to the mounted guns, you sort of take a winding path through these wrecked cars and things like that. I assume you probably could take the direct path if you were quick enough. I don't know. But it's an interesting, more puzzle-based area than anything else. And it's always great fun to watch the zombies get mowed down by the guns. So.
It is. And it's an interesting level in the sense that it's possible for you to bypass it completely, which Valve recognized, and they stop you. So,
is that the text on that? Is it one of your screenshots?
What you can do is, where all this radioactive gunk is, that if you can jump and work your way across the huge containers and things, you can get all the way around to the back. And there's another one of those scenes where there's, like, inside one of these crates or a little shed is a sofa and two skeletons arm in arm.
That's another one of your screenshots there. Interesting.
And it's kind of like another one of those things, and you think, what happened here, you know? It's just, you know, same as the bottles and the chair,
right?
You know, you think so that was quite interesting for me because I was thinking, oh my god, I've managed to find a way around that Valve didn't think. And I don't know how I feel about that because I kind of don't like a developer, you know, interrupted me, and by putting something you can't continue without the car or you can't continue without Alex, I was like, well, fuck you. Yes, I can if I wanted to. Why didn't you make it so that I couldn't get past this area? But I don't know. There was obviously, you know, a reason behind it. But I love this area. The automated gun, sniper rifle or turret or whatever you want to call it was fantastic. It's so clear to me now the kind of things that I like. Small areas that I have to work around and up and down, and I'm constantly looking for shortcuts or getting attacked from behind or of different directions. It's very clear to me that when I build my mod eventually one day, that's how I'm going to make it. It's going to be one of those, not really a huge area, but you have to travel a long distance. And I remember us having the same conversation about one of the levels in Opposing Force.
Yeah, yeah.
Where you, it's almost like a zigzag, and where you start is only a couple of meters away from where you finish, but you can't go there directly.
Right, right. Yeah, it's, you know, from a level designer's perspective, it's not only economical use of space, but it also, you know, it can serve to, like, heighten the tension. If there's an enemy that you're hiding from that's always in sight, then it's that much more riveting or adrenaline pumping because you know, if you stand up, your head will be shot, you know, within a second from this automated gun. So it adds a bit of tension if it's designed right. So
And then we managed to get back into the newly repaired and updated jalopy, which has got that radar. And wasn't really a big fan of that particular game mechanic. But for people who like to explore and, you know, looking for all of those caches and things, that's a cool kind of thing.
Yeah, I found it interesting because it's the scenery in this level and when you whenever you have this car is a lot more it's a lot more concentrated, but there's a lot more to it than being on the coast road in Highway 17. So there's a lot going on. It's hard to distinguish where you should stop or where a Lambda cache might be or where there might be something interesting. So instead of having you check out every 10 meters or sort of flag the player down with something flashing or something smoking, they added this mechanic for the radar. But again, it also pays dividends later in the finale because you need that radar. You depend on that radar to know where the enemies are coming from in the climactic battle in a couple chapters.
Yeah, you're right. And again, I hadn't considered that they introduce it in a situation where it's not so important for you to need it, but you learn from it, and then later on you need it, you should be smart enough to have used it. Now, this is an interesting section because I had a glitch, which a little bit like my, you know, being able to see out the map is for me highly unusual for Valve. There's the part where you go to the little hut or house and you can go underneath and there's a collection of weapons and what do they call those things? Things that, you know, you can see in the dark.
Flares.
Yeah. There, thank you. My car got stuck. And I got into this kind of area that everything was like frozen and I could throw a grenade and it would just, you know, freeze in midair, which was it's kind of cool. Don't get me wrong. I'm not like complaining because I know how hard Valve worked to make their games as smooth and as cool as possible. So it's kind of nice when something like this happens. It's like, ooh, look what I found.
Where was that? That was at the ambush at the White Forest.
No, it's before the before the ambush. It's not long after you start and you've started using your cache locator, and you go through a few buildings and then there's sort of one there where you have to, you know, go underground a little bit. Mm. And as you say, then we're ambushed. We get to a much bigger area and we are well and truly ambushed.
Yeah, I thought this was a great combat sequence. I found it a little frustrating, but again, I was playing on hard, so maybe I get what I deserve. But it took me quite a few tries because this is a great open. I can't say it's an open area, but there are so many paths to be ambushed. You know, so many. There's nowhere good to kind of hole up and hide.
Exactly. That's a very interesting point. You can't stay in one place in this area.
Right. And even in there's a basement there with some health and some weapons, but it has like two or three entrances. So you can't just put your back against the corner and shoot whatever comes down the stairs. It works for a while, but then they'll eventually come out behind you. So, and there's a number of hunters thrown in the mix and a couple of waves too, if I remember right. So once you clear the first wave, you have to go back up the hill a little bit, and there's another wave coming. So it's a pretty intense, you know, I tend to like, you're talking about things that we like in the games. I tend to like these areas where it's not necessarily a steady stream of enemies, but you've got these ups and downs of combat. You get something you get ambushed, you get something that's really pretty challenging. And then you have a lull, you know, you've got maybe a puzzle like the automated guns, you know, okay, yes, there's threat there, but it's not active combat per se. So I kind of like these ups and downs that they put into the game. I thought they did a great job of this chapter.
Yeah, me too. I think this is the best combat section of the game.
It's up there, but I really like the finale.
Okay. All right, which we'll come on to. Yep. And then that leads us, once we've, you know, got through the ambush there, we get a chance to drive along the river a little bit. And we meet Dog, which we haven't seen for a while. I can't remember the last time we saw him. Was it when he let us through into Ravenholm, maybe?
No. He at least tossed us across into the Citadel in the beginning of episode one.
Yeah,
that might have been the last we saw of him.
We could have been the last, yeah. And of course, we don't just see him. We sort of almost he's jumping on top of a strider. Yes.
Yeah. There's a nice little. Again, it's almost like a cutscene because you're kind of stuck there until you can proceed with the car. But nice little fight sequence between him and a strider. And I realize it's all scripted and it felt a little bit, contrived if you watch it a couple times. But the first time you see it, it's impressive. And you realize, okay, well, the Combine are definitely in the area and we're close to White Forest. So bad things are coming. But and then you get that little race with him up to White Forest, which I thought was fun.
Yeah. Too. Yeah, I didn't bother. I just let him go because I'm so bad at driving. I'd probably go off a cliff. So I just let him go. And just trying to get to the end of the screenshots now to see whether the race is basically, once we get to the top, we're at White Forest.
Yeah, pretty much reaching White Forest leads into the next chapter, which is the meaty one or the big one, let's say.
Our Mutual Fiend.
Yeah, great. Another great title.
Yes, it is, yes. Just one letter changes the whole meaning. And this is where we get to meet Magnuson for the first time, and an arrogant son of a bitch he is as well, which is perfect because, everybody's not so nice. I mean, obviously, Breen's not nice, but he's on our side. But there are times when you want to shoot him.
I tried, I tried, but it doesn't work.
Did you? Okay. and this is a great level for so many reasons. I mean, you get to see so much of what's going on in the background. You get the reunion, and you get to see the rocket, and the whole silo area is so well done.
Yeah, I thought it was great in that the beginning is a nice, as we say, kind of break from the combat. You get to wander White Forest a little bit inside. You get to see the really interesting rocket, and if you've taken the gnome along with you, you get to put the gnome in the rocket. I have not done that, but it was funny to see Lamar jump in the rocket there. So little touches like that are interesting, but to me this felt a lot like Black Mesa, the Black Mesa Research Facility. Not just the rocket, but the concrete and the feel, the lighting, it felt very much Black Mesa to me, and that's probably why it's one of my favorite chapters.
And there's a section where, after the Combine have got in and there's a few hunters running around, there's a section with these two huge pipes that sort of go up into the ceiling, and of course you can't help but think about surface tension and that kind of area. So I think they wanted us to feel this, could this be a Black Mesa type facility? And I suppose in many ways it is, because Black Mesa was supposed to be a discontinued military base. Yes.
Right. Yeah. So I think that's why it had the missile silos, I assume.
Yeah, exactly. And this one is not still in operation, but has been repurposed as such. And then, once we've got rid of the Combine, which is kind of in itself a mini boss sequence.
Yeah, I found that to be a pretty tough battle too, because there's so many of them, and there's quite a few hunters thrown in. So
and now I see it again through the screenshots. I think I might take back my this is the best combat area. In fact, I probably enjoyed this area more than the previous ambush one.
This was a really interesting use of vertical spaces here too. There were a couple of, you have to go over to Silo 2, I think it is, whatever it is, where the Combine are invading. And first, making your way over there is relatively slow, and of course Magnuson jumps on you for not doing it quick.
Being quick enough.
But then when you get there, it's quite a bit of interesting vertical combat, and again, it's just, I don't mean to harp on it, but a very much of a Black Mesa feel to it.
Absolutely. And we get to see another advisor. Just as the bay doors, or whatever you want to call them, are closing at the top, there's this advisor looking in. And,
notice that. Is it in one of your screenshots here? Oh, yeah, I see it. Okay, yeah.
You can actually shoot at him, but of course it has no effect, or it just pushes him back or something.
I don't think I noticed him, I think maybe there were Combine soldiers there a moment ago, so I was probably hiding behind the wall like a chicken. But
Well, playing on hard, that's different. I mean, I play everything on easy. Otherwise, I'd get no screenshots. All my screenshots should be red, I suppose, otherwise. So, and then, of course, you know, we've got this feeling of, phew, okay, the relief. We've got the Vortigaunt with his white coat on, which is kind of like a nice touch.
Yeah, we get a little bit of downtime. We finally get to reunite with Dr. Kleiner and Eli and you know, Magnuson again, let's say, but yeah. And there's a little bit of exposition there. You know, you finally get to Alex saying, you know, prepare for unforeseen consequences, and that triggers a reaction in Eli pretty strongly, and you know, kind of builds the intrigue even further. The problem is you don't get any answers here, of course. Get an idea that he knows who the G-Man is, but
yeah,
you're interrupted before he's able to continue, of course. You know, it's yeah, again, building tension and building anticipation for the player. And then soon we're interrupted by, immediately after that, I think we go to quick training with the Magnuson device.
We do. We just jump straight outside, and he shows us how to use
which
it.
I thought the whiteboard was great in that area. You've got
do not erase.
You've got a screenshot of it, and it perfectly tells you, you know, what to do, rather than somebody explicitly showing you or have a hologram, you know, demonstrating what to do, like in the Hazard course in Half-Life. I thought it was a great, simple but effective, you know, diagram of this is what you do.
Yeah, and even if you didn't do any of the training, if you just sort of walk past that on your way outside to the White Forest area,
exactly,
you
could say,
okay, I know what to do. It's going to be hard,
it's too bad they don't work on hunters, you know, but...
Yeah, true. And of course, the name itself, the Magnuson. I mean, we want to shoot him, but we kind of get this facsimile. We can shoot his name, or we can shoot his creation, at least.
Yeah, and of course, he makes a point of saying, oh, I didn't approve the name or something like that. But yeah, we all know he did, you know.
Yeah, of course he did. And there's another one of those scenes that's sort of, you know, when you're on your way to the testing area, there's like a fence and there's lots of crates and there's like these three rebels sitting in a very natural situation, one sort of standing up, leaning against the crate, and the other two are down. And you just get this sense of desolation, and they know something's happening, and just little touches like that that modders could learn so much from.
Yeah. I mean, although at the same time, you get a little bit of comic relief from some of the guys, too. Not quite like Griggs and Checkley, but the guy talking about how he shot an AR-3 and had an AR-3 in the...
Yeah,
in City 17.
Just bare hands.
And yeah, stuff exactly. Like I was, you know, not too over the top, and it's not too intrusive. So I thought it was a nice little aside moment there.
Yeah, very clever. All right, and then we got another map, which I thought was going to be really helpful, but once I'm actually down there, I was lost in 2 minutes. But it's, I mean, for people who are not geospatially challenged like I am, it's probably quite useful for them.
No, I'm with you too, because I studied the map, especially this time playing through, knowing what was coming up, and it didn't really help me that much. if anything, you know, preparing for the finale, the driving around several times, and honestly, during the sequence, dying and then having to replay it and driving around more and more, that's the only way you learn your way around this area. You get familiar. They did put some landmarks there, so as you're, you know, I guess we're jumping into the finale, so a bunch of Striders, you know, come with hunters,
yeah,
and they're all marching toward your White Forest base there, and it takes some time to get there, which is pretty interesting, because it allows you to kind of tackle them in various ways. What I like most about this finale is that you're given the choice of how to approach it.
Yes.
So it's I can't say it's a wide open area, but it's a very intricate area of weaving paths, and there's a sawmill in one corner and a crane in another corner and railroad tracks cutting through the middle. And throughout, they've got the Magnuson device and sort of shacks with health and ammo and that type of thing, you know, set up so you can quickly... You can only carry one Magnuson device at a time in the car. So
yeah,
I kind of wish you'd taken the time to weld on two or three brackets instead of one, but...
yeah, I'd have waited a bit longer.
Yeah, but it adds a great strategic or even, let's say, tactical approach, you know, in that you have one Magnuson device, which Strider do you go after? And you have the radar screen on your car. It's not always clear which is the closest, the most threatening to the base, yeah. But an alarm starts going off when one does get close, and you kind of know enough of your way around how to get back to White Forest, I found. So,
yeah, for me, this is what I call my BBB area. Beautiful but boring. I really recognize how such a fantastic job. I mean, they laid it out beautifully. It looks fantastic. It's strategically interesting. You've got different ways of doing it. But I hated the bloody thing. I hated every minute of it. Wow. Probably because I've got too many choices. And that is a big problem for me, you know, like these open games or role-playing games where I can build my own weapons and I can do, I don't like anything like that. I want to be given a gun, an enemy, and just told shoot a damn thing. And, you know, I'm sorry, but I didn't enjoy it. But I also recognize it's probably the best boss that Valve have ever made.
That's what I would say, yeah. I think this is the best combat finale, you know, or boss battle, if you will, of any of the Half-Life games, and
agreed.
I think a lot of other games out there, can learn from it. But I didn't find the choices to be too overwhelming. Yes, there were times I turned the wrong direction trying to get to the Strider that was, about to tear things up. But I didn't find it too frustrating in that there's still, if you look at it, there are only a handful of paths, and they all loop back on each other. So you can get lost momentarily, but I don't think you can seriously get lost because you have the radar screen to help, and usually only two or three paths to take.
I mean, you're right. You can't actually get lost. You can't just drive around for 10 minutes and then, right. Not find anything. But I just found I could never know where I was. And, which is the closest? Okay, yeah, but which is the closest to the base. I think the biggest problem for me is I'm not clear on tactically how I should approach this. You know, should I take out the hunters first, but then the Striders got further? Should I try and ignore the hunters, but then just kill, the Strider with the Magnuson? I mean, there's too many tactical choices for me, and I'm just not good enough tactically to make those choices, perhaps.
Yeah, well, for me, and I don't know if it's a difference on the skill level or not, but I really had no choice. You're not told ahead of time that the hunters can destroy the Magnuson devices with their flechette weapons until you see it happen. So the first, I remember the first time I played this, I tried, just doing the training. I took the Magnuson device, I put it on the Strider, and I tried to shoot it. But instantly, the flechette weapons from the hunters blew up the Magnuson device before I could even shoot it. And that, I think, maybe they should have made that lesson clearer in the first encounter or two that you had. But on playing on hard, at least, I don't know if there's a difference. But I had no chance of getting any of the Striders until I took the hunters around it down. It was clear cut, I cannot kill a Strider with a Magnuson device if there's a hunter within 50 meters of it, So some of them were interesting because the Strider would lead the hunters. The hunters would be a good, 50, 100 meters back, but there would be two of them and they'd be running to catch up. So if you tried to stop quickly, kill the Strider, they were probably quick enough to catch up and shoot your Magnuson device down. So you almost had to hunt for the hunters to make sure they were not in the area before you got out of your car and grabbed the Magnuson. So that's what I found really interesting tactically about this, is that they didn't just, yes, it's the same thing repeated over and over, but the landscape is varied enough and there's enough cover from rocks and buildings and things like that to make it not very straightforward for you. I can't say there's a ton of tactical choices because I definitely had to take down the hunters first.
Okay.
And I always tried to use the car for it because that was the quickest way to do it. But they have that damn sidestep built into their AI that if you're bearing down on them in the jalopy and you're within about 10 feet, they jump to the side real quick. And there's nothing worse than
it's that. It's hard. Yeah, yeah. This would have made a very interesting co-op level. I mean, I'm sure Synergy or... I don't know if any of those mods actually support Episode 2, but...
I don't know.
If I was in this with a group of people and somebody was leading and said, okay, Philip, your job is just to do this, I'd have been much happier about the whole thing. But because I had to do everything, had to kill the Hunters, kill the Striders, check everybody was okay, you know, get the Magnuson device, it was just too overwhelming for me.
Wait, so and, you want to... Normally you want to go it alone, but now you want help. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, I want to go out alone until it gets too hard, you know.
Right.
When the going gets tough, Philip calls for help. That should be the new phrase from now on. But yes, it's a masterpiece, and it's a masterclass in design. It's a masterclass in probably beta testing as well, because they probably didn't start with anything that resembled this.
I would guess. Yeah, I have, actually have not gotten up to this chapter listening to the developer's commentary, but...
Okay.
I'd be very interested in seeing what they had to say about this whole finale sequence here.
Yeah. I mean, I would be so surprised if they said that it's more or less how we started with it, because it just seems too, not too evolved, because that makes it sound too artificial, but it's certainly got the feeling that it's gone through lots of stages and they found lots of problems and they solved lots of problems until where we are now.
Yeah. And, you know, and one of the interesting aspects of this is that actually as the battle progresses, if you lose buildings to the Striders, it actually gets tougher for you.
Because there's less Magnuson.
Right, devices. Exactly. You have to drive further and further away to replenish your health and ammo and the Magnuson device. So in a certain respect, it gets more concentrated geographically because you're more and more toward White Mesa. White Mesa. White Forest.
White Mesa.
But at the same time, you have to drive further, and there's more chance of getting, you know, making a wrong turn or whatever.
Taking too long.
Right, taking too long. So, again, another tactically interesting aspect of this battle is that the landscape, maybe not the landscape, but the situation continually changes. Yes. One of the achievements in Episode 2 here is don't lose any buildings to the Striders, and I don't know how that's quite possible because that sawmill goes down within like seconds. So I might have to give that a shot at a later date, but
maybe on easy first.
Yeah,
though,
maybe.
And I think just to finish on this particular sequence, not this level, but this particular sequence, is how spectacular the Striders explode. And that's clearly a reward for all of your hard work in A, getting the Magnuson device on there, and B, managing to shoot it.
Right, right. They don't just collapse, they kind of you all over the place. Yeah, it's great.
And if they did just sort of die as if their nerve center or brain had been taken out, I'd have felt that was like, oh, that's, you know, okay, it's great, I've killed it, but I want something in return. It's, you know, it's an explosion. So that was a nice touch.
Right, that. Well, that's where Valve really took advantage of their engine advances in Episode 2. And we saw the same thing at the beginning in the big train bridge collapse. It's what they call cinematic physics. And it's really a combination, I guess, of pre-built sequences, but letting the in-game physics calculate exactly how things go down. Literally go down. It's because it's usually building collapses, let's say.
The bridges.
Yeah, but it ends up, however it works, it ends up being pretty impressive. You know, I mean, the you were talking about the rewards for blowing up a Strider, but even the penalty for losing a building, if you're in the vicinity at the time, you still get a pretty cool collapse of the building. So it's not that bad, you know. And let's hope they continue these small engine advances in their Source 2 whenever that may debut. So
had they actually done any of that? I mean, yeah, I suppose they did it right at the beginning. Right at the beginning with the breach.
Yep.
And then right at the end, was there any point in time where we saw a building collapse in the same way?
Not that I can think of. They might have used this effect in other more subtle
ways.
Some ways, but it's at its most impressive and, of course, draws your attention the most when it's a large set piece that's collapsing or blowing, whatever is happening. And it was, like I said, it's in addition to the Episode 2 engine, whatever they call that source, 2007, I suppose.
I'm just thinking that they've done a great job of introducing it and saying our engine can do this, but then not showing you it again until you're right up close And, you know, you get the real effect of it. That was like a clever touch because they could have overused that.
Yeah, well, I think in general, maybe it's not really the finale, but it's really the combat finale, the climax, if you will, of episode two, brings together a lot of different ideas. One is the collapsing buildings and the engine improvements. The other is, the hunters really are not just, you know, a threat here, but they prevent you from reaching your goal directly because they destroy your Magnuson devices, and your practice with the bringing down the chopper a couple of chapters ago, throwing the bombs with the gravity gun really pays off in using the Magnuson device directly on the Striders. So, the worst thing that happened to me was you mow down the two hunters that are accompanying a Strider, and then you miss when you toss the Magnuson device. That's the most frustrating thing. But yeah, I thought, just to sum up, I don't mean to go on and on, but this was a great finale battle. And I wish there were more like it, maybe not exactly like it, of course, but sort of a different approach to a combat finale rather than a typical boss battle. Now, we haven't really seen a typical boss in Half-Life 2 or Episode 1. You know, sort of the Strider maybe in Episode 1, but... Nothing like in Half-Life or Opposing Force, certainly. So.
No. You're right. And unlike other games, which only lead up to the final battle or the boss battle in the sense that it's the last thing you do, this has been Episode 2 has been crafted specifically to lead up to that battle.
Right.
I wouldn't have been surprised if when you do read the commentary or you hear the commentary, they said, we actually started with this and we decided to work backwards. And how are we going to introduce to the player the mechanics required, the graphic advances we've made? How are we going to make this as spectacular as possible? Well, let's start with that and see what we want and then work backwards and lead them into it.
Yeah, and even the car, it gets upgraded one thing at a time, sort of. You get the first of the bear car, which is still, you know, kind of cool looking, but then it gets the radar upgrade, and then it gets the Magnuson device attachment upgrade. So it's,
there's no way that they could have done that and then said, let's use those things for the finale. They must have had everything in mind when they first built the game.
Yeah, they certainly produce polished games.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And then that leads us on to the last chapter, which, as you pointed out, has possibly the best name of any chapter within the series.
Right.
And I honestly hadn't noticed it until you said it, which was the T-1.
Right. Which, I mean, on its surface, of course, refers to finally launching the rocket. But, you know, nobody's... who's listening to this has hopefully not played episode two. So we know that Eli gets it in the end, and it really is minus one from our group. So,
yeah. And not, well, I don't take it as our group. I see T as our team.
Fair enough. Yeah.
You know, team minus one. That's kind of how I, you know, not time, but team. And I mean, it's a really non-event level in the sense that you don't do anything. You can't change anything. You can't affect. You can't shoot. You can't do anything. It's almost the ultimate cutscene that Valve have created.
It really is. It's a nice... It sort of serves a couple purposes. It's a really nice payoff for what you just went through and reaching White Forest and then going through the big battle. And finally, maybe shedding a little bit of light on Eli's, situation or history. Not enough to get answers, of course, but in classic Mark Laidlaw fashion, you never get many answers. But it also really, really teases and sets up the beginning of what's to come, either Episode 3 or Half-Life 3. And, it leaves you wanting for more, of course. It ends on quite a bit of a cliffhanger, maybe even more so than the top of the Citadel situation. So, it was very well done. It's a nice little reward. It's not really a cutscene, but at the same time, you're right, you don't do much. So,
yeah, it's very, very clever. Now, William from Podcast 17 told me that he cried at that particular point, and they've done a great job of making it very emotional. And I think the fact that you couldn't do anything adds to that.
Yeah.
You're helpless.
Exactly. You're in the same situation you were with the advisor a couple chapters ago. And it's not a common vantage point to be in Gordon Freeman's HEV suit.
No,
let's say you're usually well armed and able to do whatever you want, but able to fight at the very least.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we have become accustomed to saving the world. We have become accustomed to being able to kill every particular adversary that has come our way. But we have not reached our match, because I'm sure that won't happen. But in this game, we've reached the point where, we can't kill the advisors.
Right.
And it opens up so many other possibilities. Why did... not why, but how much did Eli know about the G-Man? Was the Eli killed specifically because of his knowledge, or was that just a coincidence?
And more importantly, does the Combine now have that knowledge? Since they sort of allude to the Combine sort of, sucking out the brains.
It's
more or less maybe a physical suggestion more than anything, but you get the idea. And I think they specifically mentioned that if Eli were to fall into the wrong hands. Made to talk, the resistance would be in a lot of trouble. And maybe, we're exactly in that situation now, because we don't know exactly how the advisors work with their sucking out the brain thing.
So and things. Yeah.
It might really simply be a metaphor for reading his mind and absorbing his knowledge.
Could be. And we've already gone through the point of we've saved Eli once, in the sense that, we got him out of the Citadel before.
Right.
When you were the first time in that situation, did you think, okay, maybe there's something I can do, but there's nothing you can do.
Yeah, it's as soon as you're knocked down and your weapons kind of go away, then, it's, a dog does help you a little bit by jumping on one of the advisors, but... at the very least, they don't destroy your helicopter, so that's still waiting for you, I think.
Yeah, which, of course, everybody's guessing that this is, our next journey, because we seem to start each of the games, okay, not episode one, but very near the beginning, there's a journey. In Half-Life, it's the tram. In episode, in Blue Shift, it's the tram. In Opposing Force, it's the tram, yes?
Yeah, well, the Osprey ride, yes. Much
the Osprey ride, sorry. Yep. Yep, sorry. And then, of course, in episode Half-Life 2, it's the train.
Yep.
Episode 1, it's not really the a journey, but it's when Dog throws you through the Citadel.
Right.
I mean, you start off with this. Half-Life 2, episode 2, you're on the train. So... we got to think that, the next installment will be starting in that helicopter.
Could be.
But maybe not. Maybe not.
The other thing I wanted to point out quickly in this chapter was before the whole sequence in the barn there with Eli and the advisors was the rocket launch. And
yes.
I thought that was a really impressive sequence. I mean, not only does it harken back to the end of On a Rail in Half-Life, where you're the person launching the Lambda satellite into space.
Yep.
You get to press the button to launch it here as well. But it's the bunker there and at the edge of the silo is built specifically for you to be able to watch the rocket all the way up into the upper atmosphere.
Yeah.
It sounds convincing. It looks great. And you get to watch it all the way up to, as it reaches space, which was another cool payoff for completing the episode.
True. True. So here we are. We're at the end of the game. Did you enjoy it more this time, or more the first time, or the second time?
Maybe more this time. And it's hard to put my finger on why, other than it being part of this whole replay event has really solidified it as one of the very top Half-Life games, in my opinion. I thought where its strength, it doesn't have many weaknesses. So it's strong throughout. You may nitpick with the finale battle was maybe a little frustrating, or you didn't like the caves, which the caves that weren't my favorite either. But there's certainly no boring parts to it. There's a couple of semi cutscenes, which third or fourth playthrough maybe get a little long in the tooth. But in general, it's really high quality throughout, and there's
agreed.
Very little. That's a decent amount of downtime, but there's no frustrating, boring times. That's for sure.
No. I agree. I mean, I'd put it definitely in my top three. And the top two would either be Half-Life 1 or Opposing Force. Mm. I'm not really sure. I love the, you know, the shock roaches, the shock roach and the shock troopers, and just some of the aspects of Opposing Force. But probably Half-Life 1, followed by Opposing Force, followed by Episode 2. That would be my order. I enjoyed this more than I did Half-Life 2.
Yeah, interesting.
So, you know, I can see why people would put it at the top. And that's it. And we're done now. Now, the only thing left is there will be one more podcast, which is going to try and recap the whole event. We're not going to be talking about the games themselves too much. We've got a couple of ideas, but at this point, we won't tell you too much. So expect that probably next week, maybe sooner, but it's unlikely. Any final words on episode 2, Don?
No, other than where's Half-Life 3, you know? I mean, people have talked about it. It's been 6 years, like we've said, since episode 2, and people have been talking about it, and there are some upcoming announcements from Valve next week, as I understand, but
yeah.
I'm not holding my breath. But they must be working on it. There's no question in my mind.
Mine too.
They're a big company now. They've got 200-some people. They work on multiple projects. They've left this as a cliffhanger. They've not ended the story yet, so we'll just have to wait some more.
Me too. I'm going to stick my neck out and say that the three announcements they're going to make next week are, you know, details of the Steam box, details of Source 2, and details of Half-Life 3. That is what I'm going to stick my neck out. It'll probably be three completely different announcements.
We'd like to announce the sale of hats in Half-Life 3.
The real hats. We're going to open a shop in some New York next to the Apple Store, and we're going to sell real hats.
Right. And if you buy one, then your character in Team Fortress 2 gets it as well. I
yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I probably will be, but...
I bet they'd sell a lot of hats if they did that, actually.
Probably would.
Who knows? So I'd like to thank you for joining me on this podcast, and thank the listeners for listening for so long. Haven't worked it out exactly, but at this point, because we had a break in the recording, as you'll probably know, it's probably about an hour, so it's quite a long one.
Yeah, probably more than that, but it's a worthy episode. I think there was a lot to talk about.
Yeah, interesting stuff to talk about. So thanks very much, Don, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Remember, finishing Half-Life is just the beginning.